Donald Reel number 8.
Yes, we were talking about the effort over the Schleswig-Holstein coast. Yes, Openshaw hit this, bounced, sort of hit the top of a wave, just managed to stay, everyone got off, and managed to score a hit on one of the sheds. And as far as I know, that's the only plane or the only hit we got, because what happened is that every single plane we put out, including my own, simply turned us over tip going to the impossible sea conditions, artificial sea conditions. If it hadn't been for this appalling swell put up by the destroyers, the sea conditions were perfect. As it was, they put up this appalling swell. You couldn't do a thing with it, and we only lost one chap. One chap did, when he bounced badly off the water, caught his wingtip in the destroyer's mast and was killed. But the main thing I remember about it was seeing at least 7 or 8 fins and rudders sticking up out the water with Sopwith Aviation Company Kingston upon Thames written on, and that was all that was visible of the Sopwith Schneiders.
This is very interesting, because from memory, I think what the official history says about this is that due to unfavourable weather conditions, 8 out of 11 seaplanes failed to take off, and of the three that did take off, only one actually got to Tondern, and that didn't hit anything.
Thank you very much, Mr. Lance. In that case, my memory's not so bad. I knew that one had got through, but I only personally saw 6 rudders sticking up by the water, one of them being my own. And it so happened that Engadine, we had 4 or 5, I think, out of the Schneider Cup machines aboard for that special stunt. We actually recovered all our machines very little damaged. You know, superficial damage. But the fact remains they were ass up with care, as the saying goes. And a very promising show was not a failure owing to weather conditions. It was a failure owing to artificial sea conditions caused entirely by senior top brass officers who were very anxious about the danger of an imaginary submarine, which wasn't there actually, might have on one of their ships, and knew nothing about aircraft or seaplanes. So we made a mess of the whole operation, and we lost, as you tell me, 8 aircraft and 1 pilot, just because somebody didn't know the limitations, and not only that, went ahead and created the very conditions that we couldn't function in.
In your judgment, the remaining aircraft would have had no difficulty in taking off?
It's not a matter of judgment, it was absolute fact. It was a perfect day for the seaplanes.
Just for the record, this raid on Tondern involved both Vindex and Engadine.
Yes.
That's right, isn't it?
Yes, and I was now, I'm now back in Engadine. I don't have a...
Now, in November of 1915, I believe you had a short temporary posting to HMS Vindex. Could you describe this seaplane carrier for me and her air component?
Yes, it was a temporary posting. I don't know whether it was intended to be temporary or not, but circumstances certainly made it rather temporary. In the middle of November, and she was had been more newly converted than Engadine, and I think rather that most of the personnel hadn't very much experience of actual seagoing with seaplanes. And she was based on Harwich and attached to the light cruiser squadron under the famous Commodore Turret, better known as Com T, who was a very efficient naval officer, believe me, and quite keen to use aircraft when suitable use could be found, because the Felixstowe air station was just on the other side of the peninsula where the big flying boats were beginning to function from, or small flying boats then. But it was largely a matter of getting the rather difficult flying conditions in that river, I forget the name of it, at Harwich. There wasn't really much room for manoeuvring. The tide was appalling, and getting the crane crews properly trained. The ship herself was very much the same layout as Engadine, and the handling was exactly the same, except I'm afraid it was an awful lot slower to begin with. And then there was a very special stunt. She'd won a big development on Engadine. She had a very small foredeck with a little shed up forward in which one Bristol Pup, that lovely little single-seater fighter, was kept. That was for chasing Zeppelins. That could really go places. It was a marvellous little fighter plane. And with the Bindex going reasonable speed ahead, you could take the Bristol Pup off very nicely. Purely a land plane, no floats or anything like that, and chase the Zeppelin.
So unlike Engadine, she actually had one aircraft which she could fly off.
She had the one thing on Engadine, I'd forgotten momentarily about that, because Byron or test flight, we didn't really get any chance to use it at sea during the time I was there. The snag about the it was an excellent idea for chasing Zeppelins, and I believe one or two of the lads later on certainly didn't make direct contact, but they chased the Zeppelins up to such a height, they lost so much hydrogen on the way up, that when they came down at the keel end, they fell out of the sky because they no longer had enough support. We didn't find that out until after the war, but the RNA certainly bagged two or three Zeppelins we didn't know about at the time. The main drawback to the small Bristol flying off the foredeck was, of course, after you chased the Zeppelin, well, the North Sea is a big, big place, and you have a small single-seater land plane, and you run out of petrol, you just land her on the water and wait till she sinks. Certainly there's nobody going to be there. There's no shipping or anything in the middle of minefields, and you can't expect anyone to go out and look for you. So the general idea was that she would float for about 20 minutes. And somebody had quite a bright idea, which did improve the prospects rather, by stuffing the fuselage with ping-pong balls, and they floated quite a bit longer. I didn't see the actual test, but I believe one of them floated for about 2 hours, which is quite an improvement. We did, after I had left Bindex, I'm afraid two of the lads that I knew very well were lost that way. I mean, they were never seen again. It was just a matter of going out chasing a Zeppelin and then just missing.
Were there any other points in which Vindex contrasted with Engadine?
Well, I think from the operational point of view, that having the use of a plane that could take off the deck was a tremendous advance, and a mighty useful one. And as I say, I wasn't there long enough. I was only attached to Vindex a matter of about 3 weeks altogether, because one of the special stunts which I rather think I'd been sent down there for was a test of bomb capacity and carrying load, which I think I didn't know then, which I now realise was leading up to the Schleswig-Holstein-Tonder attack, which proved a washout owing to weather, but this was an attempt to do it mainly by use of the shorts, which was the bigger short seaplane with two 225 horsepower Sunbeam engine. Very good engine, and a very nice seaplane with a very good range. But the trouble is, in the usual enthusiastic way, some experimental chap, well, first of all, there was a new pattern of bomb like look up them very much because I saw the bombers inclined to go off as you gave them a cross look. We had to carry 412-pounders and about 8 25-pounders, which actually, with an observer, was an overload. Found that out. They didn't like the look of it. They didn't like the feel of it on the water, let alone in the air. But the thing was, we had to try a take-off and height and climb and, in other words, a sort of practice for the projected raid on Tondon.
Yes.
And so we went out with the light cruisers for this trial spin on the, I remember the date very well, the 4th of December 1915, and it just turned into one of these hopeless days that you can get on the East Coast there. Glassy, flat, calm, and a bit of a haze, which we didn't know then was going to develop into a pea soup fog. Of course, I may say Commodore Tirrett would never have sent the planes off, because he was very cooperative. He knew how to cooperate with both pilots and everybody else.
Yes.
However, we got going, and owing to the calm nature of the water, as far as I remember, I don't think anybody else managed actually to get unstuck going to the heavy load of bombs.
No one else managed to actually get up in the air.
I don't think so. I didn't hear of anybody actually taking off. And when... But I did a bit of practice with the old Avros and other planes at Dundee and elsewhere and managed to get the shot unstuck after a very long run. And it was a matter of how high could you get her up to with this load. I could feel she was hopelessly overloaded. But I did actually get her up to about 3,000 feet. I'm looking at the log at the moment, I can hardly believe it myself. But in the meantime, one of these appalling pea soup fogs that can develop in wintertime on the East Coast down there came on. It really was. It's so thick that, this is no exaggeration, the light cruiser squadron was several miles offshore, naturally, actually came to anchor to avoid ramming one another. So I was told later on. That's not a thing they do nowadays because they no radar or anything like that then.
Meanwhile, you were up in the air in this.
Well, I was up in the air with instructions to find out how high I could get and how. We didn't have a full tank of petrol and about enough for an hour and a half or so. And this overload of bombs and then come back down and rejoin the flotilla. Trouble is, by this time it was got so thick down below. It was beautifully clear and sunny up above, but the entire North Sea and England seemed to be covered with this blanket of fog. Nowadays, of course, what you would do would be to fly solemnly north until you found a clear bit, no matter whether you were 100 or 200 miles away from the fleet or not, but the fact remains that you're supposed to stick by the fleet then, but in any case, I didn't have enough petrol to get very far, get all that far. It was a matter of getting back to the... And the only way you could tell where the fleet was, you could see a patch of smoke on top of this fog, which was maybe about 500 or 600 feet thick. So the thing was to bring her down somewhere... on a strip of water roughly supposed to be somewhere between that smoke and England, assuming that the smoke was where the fleet was and that England was still where it ought to be. But with the fog we had, it was pretty difficult.
Yes.
And so I started on a very flat glide, and because of the fact load of beautiful bombs on board, I wasn't the least bit keen on hitting anything unduly hard. I set her on a course just about north, which should keep England on the one side and the fleet on the other, and getting lower and lower and lower. And it was very thick. I remember seeing a destroyer's mast whiz past about 3 feet off my wingtip, and I'm quite sure he was on his wrong side of the road, but the fact remains there he was. Mm-hmm. And I didn't think he should have been there.
Yeah.
And we're getting pretty near the water now, and began to flatten out a bit, the engine shaking over nicely and keeping us pretty flat. You couldn't see a thing. Not even a mermaid, in spite of the fact that the altimeter was registering minus 200 feet. And the observer looking out in all directions, and suddenly we just saw just a little glint of light in the water. It was marvellous. It was a good thing I flattened her out, just saying, who were there? That moment, a horrible, great, brown mass appeared right in front of the plane. Theoretically, you can't stop a seaplane doing 65 knots. You can't stop her dead. I can assure you this one did. It turned out later on that it was a sandy cliff. The neat old short seaplane, mind you, what a plane. She'd zoomed neatly up the cliff, only hit the very top, spread herself over about half an acre, in the middle of a very comfortable little army fort. And not one bomb went off. Not one bomb. It really was miraculous. And about an hour or two later, when they woke up, we found ourselves being very, very pleasantly nursed by a lot of very nice army chaps who turned out the garrison of the fort. They showed us we hadn't done any great damage and to speak of, and that was that. So we only had about a few days in hospital because it was damn all wrong with a very mild concussion. But if anybody else had landed a seaplane at full tilt on the cliffs with a full load of bombs on and only got very mild concussion, I'd like to meet them.